Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you. I'd first like to thank the organizers for their graceful invitation that I was pleased to accept. I will be today talking about Ulpian, so Domitius Ulpianus. If you have ever read a Latin legal maxim, a rule of Roman law, or a legal principle, if it's not from Cicero, it is highly likely that it is from Ulpian. So what we're going to be discussing today is the transition of sovereignty and universality from the national to the international, the formation of the ethical sovereign as a concept, the concept that would then be the foundation of international criminal law. Discussing the ancient roots of a modern concept is an enterprise that is fraught with difficulty. International criminal responsibility, the idea that a number of acts resulted in criminal liability irrespective of national or jurisdictional limitations, is a concept that transcends several of the boundaries of modern conventional modern law, such as national sovereignty, the powers that are normally associated with it, including the capacity to exercise exclusive jurisdiction and to determine the crimes that this jurisdiction would be used to cover. However, because these very ideas are exclusive jurisdiction and national sovereignty, are deeply rooted in the modern concept of the nation-state. Approaching the pre-modern ideas and practices of jurisdiction and its limits enables us to see not only the origins of modern conventions, but also the limitations that are inherent in them. The purpose of my paper is to explore the roots of international criminal responsibility, a task complicated by the fact that the notions of crime, state, and the word international were unknown in their modern forms. Using the writings of ancient Roman jurists, and especially those of Domitius Ulpianus, who lived roughly between the years of 170 to 223, is commonly known as Ulpian. The paper analyzes the transformation of concepts such as sovereignty, responsibility, universal jurisdiction, and authority. Of particular interest is the influence of the Stoic doctrine of cosmopolis, the universal community of men, as a framework that informed the transformation of the Roman legal thought. For Ulpian, the key to the transcending of the systemic limits of law was the near universal authority of the emperor and its manifestations in law. Rather than to understand law as a function of power, Ulpian links it with the ethical demands of justice and humanity, presenting a solution to the problem of power as theorized already by Seneca. As pre-modern jurisdictional order was commonly based on a personality principle, issues such as citizenship, legal privilege, and property were fundamental in the formation of the understanding of sovereignty, jurisdiction, and their limits. Because modern international law was founded on analogies of Roman private law, the paper will delve into ways that Roman legal doctrine was adapted and utilized in the making of the international legal order. The role of Roman jurists, and Ulpian in particular, in the development of international criminal responsibility has thus far been little covered in scholarship. The main recent study of Ulpian, Tony Honoré's Ulpian, Pioneer of Human Rights from 2002, does not cover international criminal law, and the studies of Ulpian comprise only by some articles, none of which take up the topic. The whole concept of jurisdiction in Asian international law is underdeveloped, to say the least, the last article on the matter being from the year 1933. I am writing a piece on the matter to fill this gap at the present time. The paper will first trace the life and career of Ulpian, looking at his transformative influence in not only the Roman legal tradition, but equally the development of jurisprudence in general. He represents a crossroads in the Roman legal tradition, being a central figure in the Severan revolution of law, where the legal system began to fully realize the implications of the unfettered power of the emperor and the conceptions of sovereignty. And the subchapters will take on these fundamental concepts one by one. While the influence of Stoicism in the field of law has been long debated, in the case of Ulpian, the impact is potential significance, especially in the concept of cosmopolis, because such ideas can be seen as the beginning of the fundamental transformation of the legal doctrine as liberated from the bounds of municipal law. Ulpian was not, and I should emphasize this, he was not an international lawyer. Being an international lawyer would have been an anachronism in this period. But he laid the groundwork for the doctrinal division between different types of law that would later be adopted in the international legal discourse. For example, according to Ulpian, while the Roman citizens were subject to jus civile, the civil law, or law of the citizens, all people, regardless of status or origin, were subject to jus gentium, the law of all nations. However, what he meant by jus gentium was not international law, but Roman law, specifically the Roman law that applied to all. The main sources are the writings of Ulpian that have come down to us. The discussions on Ulpian must take into account the kind of the convoluted textual history of transmission and preservation, because the writings are not come directly, but through the 6th century compilation called the Digest of Justinian, and thus they are seemingly reproductions, but basically they are very heavily edited and selected and amended to correspond to the legal situation sometimes half a millennia later. However, what is certain is that the rediscovery of the text of the Digest and the writings of Ulpian therein in the year 1135 led to an unprecedented revival in the study of law and the understanding of jurisprudence. Thus, the work of Ulpian is not significant not only due to the crucial importance in transformation of ancient Roman law, but equally in the way that it transformed the European understanding of law during the Middle Ages. So Ulpian, the main character of this inquiry, was a Roman imperial official during the Severan period. Like most of the fundamental characters of a groundbreaking historical development, he was not truly unique, but rather a culmination of a number of tendencies and one of many similar characters of the period. What makes Ulpian so important are two things. First, his extraordinary productivity and the fecundity of his ideas. And the second, that his work not only resolved many of the crucial legal problems that had been dividing the legal profession, but equally presented jurisprudence with a new philosophical foundation based on the application of the Stoic doctrine. The career of Ulpian was one spent during a time of instability, mass murder, and emperors with murderous tendencies. For the main part of his official duties, he was employed in the imperial legal service, answering petitions and legal queries sent by the population to the emperor. Of his writings, none have survived intact. We know the titles of many of his books because they are mentioned in the Digest. And in total, there are roughly 300,000 lines of text ascribed to him. So that's a really substantial corpus of ancient writings. Because of the exalted status of Ulpian and the role his writings have had, he has often been raised as an intellectual figure. Part of this stems from the fact that his career corresponds with that of Cassius Dio, one of the most prolific historical and political writers of that era. Dio mentions Ulpian frequently, as do other writers, giving him an exposure and visibility beyond other lawyers of the era. Ulpian's thought and his writings have been seen as a profound influence on the way Rome's legal policy was shaped. Because of the fundamental issues of law and humanity in the writings of Ulpian, he is linked with the philosophers of the era. One of the most interesting possibilities that have been raised is the role of Julia Domna, the mother of Emperor Caracalla and the wife of Septimius Severus. The Greek philosopher Philostratus mentions in his work the circle of intellectuals around the Julia Domna when she was in Rome. This circle included many of the most famous scholars of the era, including philosophers and writers. And there were also numerous esteemed jurists, of which Philostratus mentions Papinian, Ulpian, and Paul. Some critical scholars have doubted this and whether the reliability of this information is correct, but the indications are very enticing. Would Ulpian, Papinian, and Paul, the most prominent jurists of the era, have been in contact with the brightest intellectuals of their day, discussing the nature of justice and humanity? Is it possible that the idea that the new conceptions of law and justice and Ulpian's idea of law as a true philosophy have been influenced by the circle? We cannot, of course, really know, since the information given by Philostratus is quite vague, but the possibilities of connections are indications that there was a shared literary and intellectual culture in which ideas circulated. So let's turn to the idea of sovereignty. Ulpian was the main formulator of the conception of the sovereign legal power. According to Ulpian, the emperor, so the ruler, was law animate. Imperial power was truly unfettered. The real contribution of Ulpian in this regard was to define the undefined imperial power, its relationship with the law. So he translated the narrative of imperial sovereignty and absolutism as they emerged in the Roman legal, historical, and political tradition into the language of law. So what Ulpian did was to acknowledge the true nature of imperial power, that is sovereignty. But secondly, and importantly, he presented an ethical ultimatum to the use of that power. So he combined the positivism of imperial law with the ethical demands that they were placed on the law. So the idea that the sovereign has an unfettered power meant that there was a claim to universal authority that is bound by ethical and moral considerations that transcend this power. Thus, even though Ulpian wrote explicitly on imperial power, discussing the Roman emperor, his ideas transcended the historical boundaries of the Roman state and became universalized in later jurisprudence. So Ulpian's work established the relationship between the emperor and the law that had important implications in how the decisions of the executive power changed the law, and this the reverberations of this continued until the 17th and 18th century in European legal and political theory. So, however, what Ulpian would demand is that the adjudication is done, was to be of the highest intellectual, ethical, and legal standard. Thus, law had to be both authoritative in form and in content. So the Roman jurists would thus envision the status of the emperor as a universal authority that wielded with sovereign power. However, that sovereign power was one established with a set of limitations imposed by the emperors themselves. Thus, the seemingly illogical and contradictory conceptions of universality and particularity were combined through the careful use of these grandiose statements and their meticulous definitions that are seeking to ensure that the imperial theory would not write checks that the imperial power could not cash. Then a few words on the idea of responsibility. So Ulpian outlined imperial power of law through two main attributes, positivism and the ethical demand for justice. Positivism was outlined via the concept of legal positivism. Emperors will create law. and therefore all legal problems could be resolved through imperial power. The ethical demand for justice meant that law and jurisprudence has an ethical or philosophical dimension to bring justice. And so what the two attributes when combined led to is a conundrum. The emperor is given unfettered power, his decisions are assumed to be ethically sound. However, a very brief glimpse into Roman history, as into the history of any autocratic government, reveals that human agents tend to be fallible, not always fulfilling the great demands of ethics. Rather than referring to the actual Roman emperors, the ethical sovereign has a counterpart in the narratives of kingship. The narrative line of the divine good king, who not only represents the living law, but also is a virtuous and just, has a rich history in the ancient world. Versions of the stories emerge in the Hellenistic literature and come to the Roman literary tradition mainly through Seneca. In his writings on the young emperor Nero, Seneca would stress these two attributes, the astounding power of the emperor and his unfailing virtue. As is obvious from the contrast between the ideal and the actual history of the reign of Nero, these two aspects were not easily combined in real life. Thus, the concept should be seen more as an ideal where the moral and ethical virtue of the ruler is more aspirational rather than something that should be assumed. So while Seneca and then Pliny write at length about imperial power and the virtue of the emperor as the true foundation of justice, the concept is quite slowly adapted in Roman jurisprudence. When it does, the Roman jurists resolve the conundrum by separating the actual person of the emperor and the legal figure of the emperor. So it's quite clear from even a cursory reading of the history of the Severan period, the emperors themselves were hardly the perfect ethical and moral persons that the good king narrative would have described. However, even the lazy and murderous emperors of the Severan period, like Caracalla or even Elagabalus, seem to leave behind imperial constitutions that are legally sound and within the doctrine of the law. This has led many to think, with quite good reason, that the emperors, meaning the physical person of the emperor, may not have had that much to do with the drafting of these legal resolutions. So by separating the private and the public person of the emperor, the jurist managed to have their cake and eat it. Even if the emperor as a person may have been a raving lunatic, the imperial bureaucracy, the legally trained secretaries, would write in a manner that the emperor would need to write and uphold the facade of the law. Michael Peachin has described this in terms of the kind of Weberian separation of the person of the position. And for the working of the law, it was important that there was the institution of the emperor and the imperial bureaucracy, not necessarily an emperor knowledgeable in the law. For the development of international criminal law, another development led to the spread of the idea of the emperor as a universal judge and legislation, the spread of Roman citizenship. Previously, in almost throughout the ancient world, there had been the personality principle applied to the administration of law. This meant that for Greeks, there would be applied the law of their hometown, for Persians, their own law, etc., etc. Rome became the great exception, bestowing citizenship to allies and even former slaves, leading to the growth of the influence of Roman law. This development came to a head with the impact of the so-called Constitutio Antoniana by Caracalla that granted Roman citizenship to the inhabitants of the empire in the year 212. The true impact of the Constitutio was unclear even to the ancient Romans. Ulpian himself wrote simply that Caracalla made all people in the empire Roman citizens. Did it mean that Caracalla switched from the long-standing personality principle in favor of the area principle? Would everybody be granted citizenship, for example, those who were just simply visiting? For the newly minted citizens in the provinces of Rome, the grant of citizenship meant that they were able to petition to the emperor, bring a case to the Roman courts, appealing all the way to the emperor. It has been claimed that this would mean that the Roman Empire became a huge single area of legal unity, a kind of cosmopolis where each and every person was entitled to seek legal recourse equally from the emperor. Though this might have been true in theory, the evidence from the imperial legal practice is inconclusive. The number of rescripts that have been preserved in Justinian's compilation do rise after 212 considerably. On an ideological level, there was a dramatic change in how much the law was thought to correspond with conceptions of right and justice. Based on his writings, Ulpian was one of the chief architects of this change in the ideological link between law and justice. According to Ulpian, law and lawyers should cultivate, quote, the art of goodness and fairness, the ars boni et equi, the quote, virtue of justice and claim awareness for what is good and fair, end quote. Justitiam namque colimus et boni et equi notitiam quobientes. Ulpian expanded the realm of the law by defining it as the true philosophy of determining the licit from the illicit. Its task was not to examine positive law, but also natural law and the jus gentium. So Ulpian's theory of law was based on the idea of natural law as the morally superior corrective to the traditional sources of jus civile and jus gentium, the law between citizens and law between citizen peregrines. Ulpian defied even the basic tenets of ancient culture, such as slavery, to took up radical positions such like the equality of man. He wrote slavery as an institution of jus gentium, but not of jus naturale, establishing the fundamental unity and equality of man. He's separating the convention of law in force from the ideals of law, allowed for the simultaneous upholding of the said of the social and legal institution as an existing fact and a philosophical statement of the equality of man. And not only does this make it possible for the introduction of possibly Stoic philosophical tenets with legal theory, but enabled the internal criticism of law. For Ulpian, the conviction of the institution of emperor represent living law was true and necessary for the edifice of the law to function. And then a few words on the universal authority. So one of the more complicated theoretical issues of universal jurisdiction is how one could have both universal authority and refrain from using it. Modern national jurisdictions usually have a distinct tendency to compel judiciary to resolve issues that fulfill certain criteria that fall under the jurisdictions. The Roman jurisdiction, outlined by Ulpian, was different in a number of ways that are interesting in the foundations of international criminal law. First, that the jurisdiction was apparently universal, not bound by jurisdictional boundaries. Second, that the emperor had wide discretion of which cases he would take. So under Ulpian, Roman imperial jurisdiction was both voluntary and universal, meaning the emperor could choose whether he heard a case and gave a ruling. That a state would claim to have a universal jurisdiction was fairly typical in the ancient world. The Roman state considered, like the Greek states or Hellenistic cities, considered themselves to have universal jurisdiction. However, what the idea of Roman idea of territoriality was that it was fluid and usually based on land. There was never in the Roman legal or political discussion, the claim presented that Rome would rule the waves or anything like that. The sea was res communis, whereas the issue of piracy was significant in another way regarding jurisdiction, the ideas behind international criminal law. Since piracy was an existential threat, because interruptions in the grain supply would mean starvation, pirates that were caught were dealt with quickly and painfully. And as was mentioned, Cicero called pirates the enemies of all kind, of mankind, hostis omnis gentium, the probable source of the expression hostis humani generis, the enemies of humankind. So the importance, to conclude, The importance of the Roman conceptions of sovereignty, territoriality, and jurisdiction rest on the way that they were reused during the Middle Ages and early modern period to justify claims of universality and sovereignty. And through these usages, the Roman language has slowly made its way into the modern terminology of international law. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.